I'd like to talk this evening. Sometimes we're talking about politics, sometimes we're talking about all kinds of things. I'd like to give a talk about more about the formal aspects of practice this evening, but really to apply it also to our daily lives. So I'd like to talk about the way two aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path relate to each other, the quality of right intention or correct or wise intention or balanced intention and right effort. So just a reminder, I think most of us know this, but essentially the Buddha said, if you want to be free, cultivate deeply eight things. Cultivate wisdom or understanding. Cultivate a clear and powerful intention. We'll talk about that. Cultivate by purifying your speech, your action, and the way you work, your livelihood. Cultivate a deep and sustained effort in your spiritual practice, and cultivate a deepening and powerful and purified mindfulness and concentration. Those eight things. I think it's important to start at the starting place, for me, the starting place of everything about the Dharma relates to the fact why we're doing this. We're doing it to be free. And what is freedom? It's really simple. Keeping it really simple and direct, the Buddha said, what is freedom? It is freedom from greed, freedom from hatred, and freedom from ignorance. That is freedom. So I think the important thing is for us to be very clear about what our deepest intention is. Because unless we have the intention to be free, to liberate these hearts and minds, and we know what that means, it means freeing these hearts and minds from greed, hatred, and ignorance, unless we have the intention to be free, we're just going to wander around. You have to want to be free. You have to want to be free. You have to want to be free. And do you? Is that your intention? Is that, have you set that intention for yourself? The Tibetans talk a lot, the Tibetan Buddhists talk a lot about bodhicitta, that is a awakening mind. And it's really about setting this intention deeper and deeper in our hearts. And at some point, for many of us, that intention deepens and expands to include an intention for all beings to be free. So that's the deep intention around which all of our lives and all of our practice can configure. Without that intention, not much happens. And I think what can happen for us, for many people, somebody might come to a talk like this just kind of interested, what is this Buddhist thing? And or someone might get involved in meditation practice with lots of really wholesome intentions, like I want a little more calm in my life, or I want better relationships in my life. I want a little more clarity. All of that is good. But at some point, I think, at some point, our intention deepens to this place of really wanting to be free and really wanting others to be free. So just in terms of right intention, that seems to me the most important thing. I can just say for myself that I frequently repeat to myself a little ritual that I came up with a long time ago. I didn't get it from anyone. There's a little part of it that comes from Shantideva. But essentially, I just remind myself about what my intention is. And that intention is, these are the words that I use, I commit this life and all future lives to the liberation of beings from their suffering. May all my thoughts, all my actions, all my thoughts, all my words, and all of my actions contribute to this purpose. For as long as space and time endure, I will abide to relieve the suffering of living beings. So that's that intention. That's the intention which drives everything in my life. It's having, that's the this quality of bodhicitta. I can't emphasize it enough. So really, to speak about the quality of right effort or wise effort or balanced effort in our formal practice, you notice the Buddha said about freedom. What is freedom? He essentially said it's freedom from states of consciousness that actually keep us in bondage. Greed, all forms of aversion, like fear and anger and hatred and envy, and ignorance or delusion of not understanding what is true. So it's about freeing ourselves from states of consciousness. And really, what so much of our practice is about is really dealing with states of consciousness. So the Buddha described right effort in terms of our spiritual practice. He said, cultivate what is wholesome states of consciousness, and abandon what is unwholesome. So it's being very conscious to cultivate love rather than hatred, for example. And when hatred arises, abandoning it is not pushing it away and wishing it weren't there, but actually turning toward it and dealing with it in our hearts and minds, working our way through it. So really, it's paying attention again and again and again to what is really happening in this mind, in this heart, and paying attention to what's going on around us. So if fear comes, we look toward the fear, we feel it in our bodies, and we decide whether it's useful for us to believe that fear. You know, sometimes it is. If we're being stalked by a mountain lion, the fear can actually, you know, give us the adrenaline to get away from the mountain lion or to fight, to protect ourselves. That kind of fear is very helpful. A lot of our fear, a lot of our anxiety is free-floating and is not so useful to us. Just paying attention to what's happening, working with it. And I think it's really useful to pay attention to the states of consciousness, the mind states, in our environment. For example, probably most of us in this room have paid some attention, probably a lot of attention, to the debate over healthcare reform that's been going on for some months in this country. It's really helpful. It's great to know all the information, very important, know all the information. But really what's helpful is to look and see what are the qualities of consciousness that are driving people's words and their actions. Are people speaking from a quality of clarity of understanding, from compassion, from empathy? Or are people speaking from fear and anger and greed? It's really helpful to recognize those states of consciousness and to decide for ourselves which ones we want to cultivate and which ones we want to abandon around this important public issue for us. Does this make sense at all? I'm sure that a lot of us also are concerned about the war in Afghanistan as well as the war in Iraq. You know? What states of consciousness are we cultivating, we, ourselves, cultivating in response to what's happening on the public sphere in that way? And what do we recognize in the debates around these things? So you see what I'm saying? It's not just our public and political and social lives. It also has to do with our personal lives and work, paying attention to states of consciousness. Right effort. Cultivate what is wholesome, abandon what is unwholesome. These are so easy to talk about, they're so difficult to do. So if we can take this quality of right intention or wise intention, balanced intention, and bring it together with right effort in our formal meditation practice, abandoning what is unwholesome, cultivating what is wholesome. When you're meditating, and we just were for 40 minutes, if you can remember back to that experience of the meditation that just ended, essentially there are only two efforts required. There's the effort when you notice that your mind has wandered in thought, has wandered into a story, which can often be about wandering into ignorance and delusion, to make the effort to come back, to be aware of something that is happening in the present moment. The willingness to let go of the story for the time being and to come back to experience what's happening in the present moment. Essentially, what you're doing is cultivating mindfulness or awareness, and then simultaneously in our practice, we're also cultivating kindness, of touching with kindness everything that occurs to us. So one, the intention to be free, the intention to abandon what is unwholesome, to cultivate what is wholesome, and then the actual effort to come back to be present for the breath, for a sound, for a sensation, for an emotion, for thought. So that's the first effort in any meditation practice that I know about. And the other effort, with the same intentions behind them, is to sustain our attention, to sustain our awareness on whatever object we've chosen, to come back, to sustain, to come back, to sustain. But also bringing this quality of this intention, if we're clear about why we're here, because we want to be free, because we want others to be free, if we're very clear about that core intention in our lives, then also to bring this quality not only to our formal meditation practice of cultivating effort and mindfulness and concentration, but also bringing that intention and that effort to the ethical aspects of our practice, to being as committed to purifying what we say and how we communicate in our speech or in our writing, to be as committed to that as we are to being mindful of our breath. In many ways, it's more consequential to be clear, to be very clear that we're purifying our actions. This is absolutely part of our practice. To be very clear that what we do to make a living really matters. And what we do to make a living, is it cultivating what is wholesome? Is it abandoning what is unwholesome? And then I just want to talk a little bit about an aspect of right intention and right effort that has fascinated me. I just love the fact that I can sort of come and talk about anything I want on these once a month. And actually, I was planning until this morning to talk about a completely different subject. But this has been so absolutely up for me, this intention and effort around one aspect of my life, that I realized, well, you know, this is what I'm really working on. Why don't I talk about it? So, you know, as I was driving down here, I thought, well, maybe we'll talk about something else. And this has to do with intention and effort in the midst of all of the activities of our life. Just for a show of hands, is there anybody here, if you would raise your hand, who feels like you may be doing too much in your life in terms of all the activities, the commitments? Is there anyone who feels like they're doing too little in their lives? Great. Is there anyone who feels like they've got doing too much and too little in balance? Oh, great. Wonderful. Oh, I congratulate you. That's fantastic. I extend my sympathetic envy to you. I just find it so interesting because I do too much. I do too much, and I've gotten myself very tired. And I find actually it's either age or illness or maybe a combination of the two, I don't have the stamina that I used to have. So I just actually can't sustain the level of activity that I have in the past. So finding the balance, this is really about right effort. Finding the balance of effort in my life in terms of engagements and commitments, and all the rest of it, every one of the activities of my life is a moving target for me. I can maybe tell you what would be for me a balance now, but it may be very different 6 months from now. So to take this question, you know, about right intention, if it is my intention to free this heart and support all other hearts to be free, every living being in the universe, and I take each one of the activities of my life and I ask, is this really contributing? You know, I have this commitment to may all my thoughts, all my words, and all my actions support this commitment, this intention. You know, I don't have a television, but if I were watching Dances with the Stars every week, would that really be supporting that intention? It might be, or it might not be at any given time. My training is in literature, and so I love good literature. And so right now I am just making my way into Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. And it's a great work of literature. There's a splendid new translation. I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's the first time I've read it since I was 19. So it's been about 45 years, since I've read this great novel. It's very interesting to me, but I'm actually beginning to realize I don't really need to read so much great literature anymore. You know, it gives me pleasure. There's something wonderful about it. But in terms of gaining wisdom from it, you know, I've learned more from the Buddha than I will from Dostoevsky. And so I'm beginning to realize that in my life, this activity that I've been doing for 50 years is something that I'm deciding to start to let go of a little bit. It's not about, you know, some hair-shirt renunciation. It's just realizing, you know, this isn't really supporting my freedom in the way it used to. There's just one little example. And I think just asking that question, you know, if for those of us it seems as if I saw more hands up for those of us who are doing what we feel like we're doing too much in our lives, right effort, why would that be? You know, and then it's very important to look at the motivation, which has to do with intention. You know, one reason why we might be doing too much in our lives is because we're told by this society that you're only worth something if you're really busy. And we're in the most hyperactive society in the history of the world. You know, bring anyone from the 18th century, say, from any culture, anywhere, and plot them, you know, take Thomas Jefferson and plot them into the middle of this and say, what do you think, Tom? You know, it would seem crazy. The amount of information that comes, the amount of media, the amount of activities is just extraordinary. So, you know, it's like Thoreau wrote, simplify, 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 back in, you know, it was 1845 or something when he wrote that, in that hyperactive agrarian Massachusetts world. You know, he said, you know, I'm trying to remember the exact word. We come out of the something city. It's not anxious. I can't remember the exact words. You know, we basically come out of the anxious and overactive city into the anxious and overactive country. And so, if that was going on for Thoreau in 1845, imagine what he would think if he were here. So one reason why we may be doing so much is because our society is basically it's the water we're swimming in now. And we're also being told, you know, if you want to be worth anything, be really productive. So it may be the social environment may influence our intention, but to me, it's really important to ask the question, is this really serving my deepest purpose? Is this really serving the profoundest intention of my life, all this stuff? I led a retreat recently. I went away and did a retreat, and then I led a retreat right after it. So I was away for 2.5 weeks. I came home to 170 emails, and some of them really needed answers. Oh, my God. No wonder I'm tired. That was just one of the demands. One possible motivation, one possible intention comes from our social environment. But I think it's really useful to ask also, you know, what, just in terms of looking at why we do things, to what extent are we doing things in order to manage our pain, in order to manage our anxiety? You know, how often do you feel like you need to zone out, you know, by watching the television or having a drink or whatever it is that allows you to zone out? You're basically managing anxiety. And there's another anxiety that we very rarely talk about, but that is actually there, and I'm just so conscious of it recently. And that's the anxiety of believing that we're separate selves. There's this underlying buzz or gray noise of anxiety and static that comes from believing in something that isn't true and trying to maintain it. You know, so we have to manage that anxiety too. If we don't understand that there is no separation, that there's only one reality, if we don't understand that, there is a whole anxious dynamic going on. So to what degree do we do all the things that we do because we're anxious? Understand, you know, that many of us are having to scramble in this economic environment to make a living. And there's a lot of anxiety involved with that. But actually, you know, no matter what your economic situation is, whether you have work or don't have work and you're needing work, the anxiety is extra. Cultivate what is wholesome. Abandon what is unwholesome. So I just find it so useful in my life as I'm realizing that I can't do as much as I used to be able to do. I simply can't any longer. To be very clear about how do I simplify? And to really ask of these questions. And I found for the most part in my own life, you know, I've actually... most of the things that I do are really congruent with my deepest intention. Most of the things that I do, I'm either serving others or I'm trying to take care of myself. And, you know, sometimes that means I don't watch Dancing with the Stars because I don't have a TV, but I do the equivalent. I read Calvin and Hobbes, you know, or Dostoevsky. You know, sometimes it's totally appropriate in terms of self-nurturing. There, you know, so I garden and I swim in the river where I live and do other things, do a lot of hiking, do things that really nurture and support myself. And all of those things are congruent with the essential purpose of my life. But it's very, very useful for me to pay attention. And because there's a kind of momentum, unless we have a lot of clarity about why we're doing things, we just get pulled into it. There's such a pull toward distraction in this culture that we get pulled away. So, you know, people say to me over and over again, I simply can't find time to do meditation in a regular way. Why is that? Why would it be? You know, if we really want to be free, if freedom is really the most important thing to us, it might be useful simply to say, you know, short of taking care of the sick child or the sick parent or the sick sibling or one or another critically important thing in my life, I'm going to sit. Because it really serves. It really serves my freedom. If it gets crowded out by other things, do those other things serve our deepest intention? Do you have some sense about what I'm talking about here really has to do with intention and effort? And do you have any sense that certainly happens for me is where I can get click into automatic pilot. You know, I get sort of dazed in front of all those hundreds of emails. And I'm thinking about actually writing an email to everyone saying, don't ever forward me anything. If you want to communicate with me directly, a personal communication, I would be really happy for it. But I can't keep up with 300 forwards a week. You know, just so it's having that quality of intention that so often, really, in our lives, less is more. And we learn that when we go into retreat. For those of you who have been in meditation retreats, where our lives are, it's a kind of artificial environment where our lives are radically simplified. You know, the cell phones get turned off, the computers are gone, the telephones aren't, you know, nothing's there except your mind. And then you get to watch what all that overstimulation has done to these poor sad minds. And then working with it, you know, we become more balanced. We become calmer. We have more clarity. There's more happiness. So when we all realize the freedom that the Buddha talks about of uprooting from our hearts forever greed, aversion, and ignorance, our happiness will be unconditional and boundless. But in order to do that, there has to be very clear intention and very clear effort. And so I think it can be useful because I'm really necessarily, because of whatever is happening to me, I'm just up against realizing I have to do a whole lot less than I have been doing. What do I cut away? How do I learn to do less in order to be able to sustain my effort? You know, I think that kind of reflection, which I'm forced to do right now, you may not be forced to do it, but that kind of reflection can be really useful because it sometimes that kind of reflection can teach us what is most important and what serves what is most important. It's a pretty simple message this evening, but it feels like an important one. So thank you for hearing it out. Any comments or questions? Please.
Yeah. A couple times toward the beginning of the talk, you spoke of freedom. Freedom from what?
Yeah.
Greed, hatred, delusion.
Right.
And since most of us, at least we think we have a good sense of what greed and aversion are.
Yeah.
Delusion is a more nebulous. So what is someone intending when they intend to be free of delusion? And you also mentioned delusion, you just gave a little snippet definition of knowing what is true.
Yes, or believe. Actually, delusion is actually believing to be true what isn't.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
Or not recognizing what is true, and I'm just going to give you a really traditional response, but it seems really useful to me, is that essentially. Delusion is, one, believing that we're separate. That's the deepest delusion, out of which all of the other stuff flows. So there wouldn't be so much greed and so much hatred if we knew that we're not separate, because we wouldn't have something to defend, you know, and something to gratify. So that's the deepest delusion right there. Then it's also believing that our speech and our actions don't have consequences. You know, nobody has seen this, and so it doesn't count, right? It doesn't matter if I've stolen something or if I've lied or, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter if nobody knows about it. It always matters because there's always a consequence, always. So it's about understanding the law of cause and effect. And another delusion is believing that things are permanent when nothing is permanent. Believing that things are reliable and satisfactory when everything's impermanent and therefore not reliable or ultimately satisfactory. And, you know, the belief that that something is a self. So, you know, that's the traditional understanding of what delusion is. And obviously the opposite is right understanding or right. Is that useful?
Sure.
For that clarifying? Yeah. Thanks so much. Yeah, please.
Well, you mentioned that you're a Dharma teacher, and so your ultimate purpose in life is to help people be some free. But not all of us are Dharma teachers, and so what would the Buddha say about how you can decide whether your purpose in life is wholesome or not, or what you're doing,
right,
you know, in your everyday life is wholesome or not?
I think actually that's a really wonderful question. And I think that essentially, if it's wholesome, it will bring forms of happiness. You know, and it will also bring a sense of connection. Whatever brings a sense of separation is going to be unwholesome. So when you're feeling anger, for example, or anger toward a person, are you feeling connected to that person or separate? And there's no judgment about this, but just noticing the times when one feels separated, and there's almost always an unwholesome state of consciousness at work there. And so, you know, somebody said to me today, actually, everyone in our deepest hearts, we know what's good and what isn't. And ultimately, it's to pursue what is wholesome is to pursue what is good. You know, the basic goodness in ourselves and the basic goodness of others, to recognize that. Or, you know, the Dalai Lama said, he said, my religion is kindness. So if you want to configure your entire life around kindness, that would be wholesome. And it's really not about being a Dharma teacher or not being a Dharma teacher. It's just about what do I do that generates suffering in this heart and contributes to the suffering of others? I'd like to not do that. What is it that contributes to happiness in this heart and contributes to the happiness of others? I want to do that. It's really simple. And so if you take that as the criterion, you know, making an effort not to generate more suffering and pain in the world, there's plenty, but really to generate more happiness and connection, That I think is the criterion. Is that useful?
Yeah. I mean, it's almost as though it doesn't really matter within limits what you're doing in this world, as long as you sort of keep that in mind.
Right.
But then I guess there are also, each of us has their own strengths and weaknesses or whatever.
Right.
And so there's probably some areas where maybe you are more gifted than maybe I would be, and vice versa, where perhaps we can create more happiness doing a particular thing that we're good
yeah.
at.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. That's right. I mean, if you may have, for example, a skill with language that other people don't have, and you can use that skill to support more happiness in the world, or you can use that skill with language, which is really a neutral thing, you can use that skill with language to cause more separation and pain. So, you know, Rush Limbaugh. So I think it's true. You take that gift, but really, whatever your gifts are, it's really to look what are the underlying intentions with which you are going to use that gift. That's the critical thing, I think.
Thanks.
Sure. Yeah. Please.
States of being that you're determining being useful and non-useful. If you have some, let's say, grief over progression of an illness or the death of a loved one.
Right.
And you feel yourself sort of caught in that feeling where you right. know it's not serving you. And you
right.
know it's not useful, but you can't escape from it. How do you respond to
that? You know, that is a whole enormous subject. And so I'm going to give you the very short answer, but it's actually a really important question. So let's say there's the death of a loved one and you're feeling grief. You know, the first thing I think is really to understand that that's a very natural kind of response to loss. And so it's not about kind of pushing the grief away. And this is what's really important for us in our lives is to turn fully toward that grief and to embrace it, to experience it fully. But if I may suggest, what happens if we're feeling very strong grief is there's the emotion and then there's a story. Mm-hmm. And there's if the grief is strong enough, it'll be a story that is almost a compulsive story that is told again and again and again and again and again. In the mind, it goes around and around and around. And if there's any way that you can let the story go a little bit, even for a moment, let the story go and actually feel the grief itself and feel it in your body, you know, and allow it to be there to express itself in your body and in your mind without the story, you know, because the story might be, oh, I'm poor me, I've just lost, you know, why did that person die? Well, it was very inconvenient. You know, whatever the story is not helping the process. I have known people, and there are real reasons for it, but I've known people who have been caught in grief for 50 years and could never let go. You know, and ultimately, it's about, I just had lunch with a friend today who had a major loss in her life 2 years ago, and she said, you know, I'm finally getting over it. It's not that I'm not feeling sad, but I've come through. And so I think one way of dealing with grief is we separate from the story. We experience it fully in our bodies and in our minds and allow it to be there, turning toward it, touching it with kindness, but also understanding that the heart lets go in its own time and it can't be forced. You can't force letting go. You may have noticed. And so it's like being kind enough to this heart to allow it to go through a kind of natural process and to let go. And then there's one other thing, and people get angry when I say this, but I'm going to say it anyway because given the fact that you've opened to the grief, that it's understandable, that you're working with it, but ultimately grief is about resisting change. And it's really helpful to see that. You know, what is born dies. Death is certain, and the time of death is uncertain. And so, you know, a child may die at 5 minutes old, or a person can die at 97 or 98. We don't know when it's going to happen, but this change is certain. And so there's some way in which it's really valuable for us to understand that. You know, I just asked about, you know, delusion. And one of the delusions is believing that things are permanent. You know, I have this wonderful relationship and it's going to go on forever. On some level, we assume that. And it's simply not true. Everything is impermanent. And so every relationship will either end in estrangement or death. No third choice. And really to understand that. Many people have heard me say this before, but when there was a very big loss in my own life, what I did was actually to I chanted two chants. One was Pali, words that the Buddha said at the very end of his life, just before he died, the last night of his life. He said, "All conditioned things are impermanent. It is their nature to arise and pass away. To understand this truth brings true happiness." So I had this terrible loss. I was feeling intense grief. And I was reminding myself of the wisdom of the impermanence of all things from the Buddha's words. But I was also acknowledging my pain by chanting, I would alternate, Buddha, Shakespeare, by chanting King Lear's words. where he said, "For I am bound upon a wheel of fire that mine own tears do scald like molten lead." And at that moment, I was bound upon a wheel of fire, you know, and I was feeling the intense pain of it. And I was stuck. I was stuck on that wheel of fire. And so it was a way of not using the wisdom that all things pass away, of trying to shortcut the grief, but really to acknowledge, okay, the pain is here, the pain is real. I acknowledge that. I'm trying to touch it with kindness, and I'm reminding myself of wisdom at the same time. So that's the short answer to a very significant question. Thank you. Please. Right. Yes, I think that's an accurate way of putting it.
And I myself struggle a bit with trying to understand what in the, you know, so Buddhist endowment is, you know, their culture, especially in the early Buddha, and what's ours.
Right.
So I was, when you said it was part of your happiness, you know, if you were a Buddhist monastic, maybe you would read a little bit. I don't know. Maybe you read a lot. I don't know what is exactly what monastic life is like. But, you know, I mean, did that fit into your kind of Buddhist life in a way?
It's really about, I think, just, it's not about Buddhism, actually. It's really, for me, and again, this is a lifelong thing. I have a PhD in literature. So, you know, I had 25 years of schooling, and a lot of it was about literature. So it's my deepest training in many ways, and it has given me tremendous pleasure. It's just there's some way in which I don't really need that pleasure so much anymore. That I would rather sit than read Dostoevsky at this point, because sitting brings greater satisfaction. It brings simplicity and peace and a sense of wholeness and clarity. I might get those things from reading Dostoevsky, but it's like, it's almost as if, I don't know, it's like I found something deeper that brings deeper satisfaction. And so, you know, what I tend to do now is not so much, I'm more inclined not so much to pick up, you know, the 10-pound novels. I read War and Peace recently. 1,200-something pages. I'm more inclined to pick up Whitman and read three poems, you know, or pick up Keats and read, you know, some really beautiful ode, and get a little hit instead of, you know. But it's a very personal thing. I'm not suggesting that for anyone else. It's just there's a kind, something evolving in this heart.
It's about health and not being, having a completely driven life, you know, having some downtime.
Yeah.
But is there, do we understand this from a Buddhist point of view?
The Dalai Lama said, "My religion is kindness." And so we make an effort to extend kindness to others, and it's very clear to me that there are certain ways in which I can extend kindness to myself. So I live in a little rural valley that's right on the Rio Grande River, and it's about 100 yards across a field to a little beach that we have in our valley. And during the warm months, I try every day just to take a few minutes to walk back across this very beautiful field in this gorgeous valley, go to the river, skinny dip, and have, you know, just this incredible pleasure of being out in this amazingly beautiful place and swimming and using the body and the sacrament of water that is somehow amazingly renewing. And I put my clothes back on and I walk back to my house and I sit down at my computer again or do whatever else is required. And that is a deep kindness to myself. You know, just we all have different things. And that is a particular form of really deep support and kindness to myself if I can take the time to do it. And I realize what privilege. I mean, most people can't go skinny dipping in the Rio Grande. It's just the circumstance of our valley that makes it possible. Is that? Thank you. Good questions. Thanks so much, friends. May you find right effort with right intention.